come up on a tight wire.
I'm sitting across from my good friend Benjamin Alida Sines.
And I'm sitting across from my good friend Daniel Chacon.
And we really are good friends, and this is another edition of Words on a Wire.
Right here from Studio B.
And today we have a great show for you. We're going to talk to Joy Castro, who is the author of two recent books, Island of Bones, which is a collection of essays, and the novel Hell or High Water, which is a thriller set in New Orleans. And so that's going to be a lot of fun. And for our poem of the day, I think I'm going to read something by Yusuf Komunyakaa, who is one of my favorite poets.
And one of my favorite poets.
This guy's amazing.
He really is.
I remember one time I was at AWP and I was standing there and I was with a friend of mine who loves his work. I mean, she idolizes him. The elevated doors open and there he is standing right there. And she goes, and she just froze.
He's become an icon. And he deserves to be.
Absolutely. He's an amazing, amazing poet. So I'm going to read one of his poems today. So stick around, and we're going to have a great show. I'm really kind of excited that we have Joy Castro on the show. I met her recently at Vanderbilt University when I was doing a reading with her and Blas Falconer and Lisa Chavez. All of us are included in this anthology edited by Lorraine Lopez, who teaches at Vanderbilt, called The Other Latino. And it's a collection of essays that has to do with Latinos who may not fit the mold of, quote, Latino writers. And I was asked to contribute to write an essay. And so I wrote an essay about Juarez and Fresno.
Oh, I think that's great.
Making a comparison, which is kind of weird. I guess I compared the violence because Fresno is a very violent place. And Juarez, of course, has had its experience with violence and how violence sometimes, whether we like it or not, kind of creeps up into our work.
Was it difficult to write?
Yeah, it was, because it starts with my mother's death. And somehow that kind of connects. I followed the language into the essay, and yeah, it started with my mother's death. And I haven't written a lot about my mother's death. And so, yeah, it was a little painful.
You know, the only essays of yours I've ever heard or read, and really heard, are the ones that you do here for Poetic, for our Poetic licenses. I haven't read any of your essays.
That's true. That's true. You know, I don't publish a lot of them. I that was solicited, so I published that one. But I don't send them out. I think the reason why is because I'm just not ready to send them out. I'm putting a collection together maybe someday. But, you know, speaking of non-conventional Latinos, do you remember that Latino boom? It was an anthology edited by Jose Gonzalez. Yeah, he's the guy that teaches at the Naval Academy.
Oh, yes.
It's called Latino Boom, and it was basically an anthology of Latino literature from Tomas Rivera all the way to what they called in the very final part. I forget the exact title, but the idea was it was the non-conventional, the new wave of Latino writers, and it featured a story by you. They said that Ben Sines is different. So they put you in that category, too. You are the other Latino as well, Ben.
Well,
you have very middle-class characters often.
I really do.
Yeah.
I really do. I mean, in my first collection, I did have a story called Cebolleros, which I really liked, right, about my, and it was based on my experience of picking onions as a boy.
Oh, you're talking about that collection. What was it?
Flowers for the Broken.
Flowers for the Broken. Oh, I love that title.
And some of my characters in some of my novels, my first novel, were poor.
Right.
But
right.
Not all of the characters were right there. I suppose I've never wanted to represent Mexican Americans as poor and working in the fields and the mother making tortillas, though my mother made tortillas right, and they were right delicious, because that really isn't true to my experience right of being a Latino. I'm an educated man.
Right.
You know, and I don't want to misrepresent who I am and what I know and my experience.
Right.
And so my characters' struggles are not necessarily financial.
Absolutely.
But their struggles are very real.
Latino Chicano literature that deals with farm workers and deals with the poor and deals with abuelitas making tortillas on a comal, very, very moving. But the fact is, not all Latinos, not all Chicanos need to write about that. And I think sometimes there's a cultural expectation, you know, where they say, where's the abuela? Where's the tortilla? You know, where's the farm worker? And Joy Castro, who is a Cuban-American writer, Ben Sines, and many other writers that I admire, they write their own thing. They write their own thing. They don't write according to expectations of a particular genre.
And or Latino, Chicano, Mexican-American writing is evolving and changing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It doesn't stand still.
And it's diverse. Latino literature today and Latino literature 50 years ago, it's just an incredible boom. It's a Latino boom.
And someday we should actually have a show about that.
Let's do that. Let's do that. But for now, let's talk to Joy Castro. Stick around. We're going to talk to her about her new novel, Hell or High Water, and her collection of essays, Island of Bones.
Stay tuned. Today on our show, we're interviewing Joy Castro, who is an associate professor at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, in the Department of English and the Institute of Ethnic Studies. Castro's first book, The Truth Book, a memoir, was named a BookSense Notable Book by the American Booksellers Association, and her novel, Hell or High Water, was a National Latino Book Club selection. Her latest collection of essays is The Island of Bones. Welcome to our show, Joy.
Thank you.
We're going to talk first about Island of Bones. Your new collection of essays just came out this year. The book begins with the anthologies don't mention us, and this is probably a good place to start. What do you mean, the anthologies don't mention us?
Well, that essay, the title essay of the book, was originally invited by Lorraine Lopez and Blas Falconer for their collection, The Other Latino, that looked at voices from different Latino groups that often hadn't received a lot of popular recognition. And my particular background is Cuban-American, mm-hmm. and my family lived on the island of Key West starting in about 1870, so they were working class Cuban Americans for a long time, long before the bridges were built, and their history was largely erased after 1959 and Castro's revolution, because then the picture in the public mind of who Cuban Americans were became dominated, understandably, by the waves of exiles who came to the U.S. and to Florida after that time, after 59 and after. So, you know, most of the, like, Latino literature, anthologies and so on, don't really talk about that mm-hmm. older history. And so that was the story that I wanted to tell, the story of my family and my parents and grandparents and so on.
And there seems also to be a very deep cultural misunderstanding of who the Cubans are. I would imagine, like, we tend to think of them as Republican. We tend to think of them as very conservative. We tend to think of them as Catholic. And your family's none of those.
Yes, that's true. Although now, of course, that's changing as well, just even among the Cuban-American community in Miami who were the exiles and the children and grandchildren, because that's just shifting and changing so rapidly as more generations grow up in the United States. You know.
And you actually have a background, a Jehovah's Witness background, which brought you to England. You spent a lot of time in England when you were a kid. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So my grandmother, my Cuban-American grandmother, Virginia Castro, was converted from Catholicism to Jehovah's Witnesses by somebody who went to her door, you know, knocking on her door. And, you know, to her, it sounded pretty good.
She didn't have a sign on the door that says, Somos Católicas?
No, or if she did, they ignored it. And, yeah, so she converted, and she took all her children to the Kingdom Hall, and so my father, you know, was a Jehovah's Witness as a young man, a teenager, giving talks at the Kingdom Hall and so on. And my aunt Letty, she married an elder in the Jehovah's Witness congregation and so on, and my parents got married in the Kingdom Hall in Key West. So, yeah, that's what I grew up as, and that's what I knew. Now, that wasn't what took us to England.
What took us
to England was actually my father's job. He worked for National Airlines. I don't know if your listeners will remember National Airlines, but...
I remember.
Yeah. he started as the guy who would wheel the wheelchair people to the airplane and help them up the stairs back when there were always stairs.
Oh, wow.
And he kept, like, slowly climbing up the ladder in Miami. And then when they wanted to open an office in London, they sent him as one of the people there that was opening that office. So we were there for 4 years when I was very small.
So your background as a Cuban-American growing up Jehovah's Witness and living in England when you were a child, I suppose, how does that figure into your work?
Yeah, it's kind of a trippy combination and definitely unusual, I guess. And how does it figure into my work? Well, I guess the themes of displacement, confusion, bewilderment, exile, those are all very familiar to me, and they crop up again and again. And trying to figure out where you do fit, what community is your community, how you can have a voice, all those things seem to run through a lot of the work that I do, fiction and nonfiction, figuring out a sense of home, a sense of belonging, mm-hmm. who your family is.
Would you say then in a certain way, that was a kind of that kind of psychology led you to create a character like Nola in your latest novel?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, she's a Cuban-American young woman living in New Orleans, where there's not, at the time that she was growing up, not a big Cuban-American community. She's poor. She's growing up in the projects. And then she grows up and she tries to kind of pass for middle class and find a profession for herself and so on. And yeah, I think so. I think there's some of me in Nola, for sure.
And it seems that Nola doesn't like what she finds.
A lot of friction, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And is that, in a way, there's some kind of parallel? Because there's always some kind of parallel in what we write and who we are. But, you know, of course, there are different things.
Sure.
You know, it's not autobiography.
Right.
When you look back in your journey to discovery and you use that for your writing, are you sometimes disturbed by what you write or surprised and think, oh, my God, I wrote that?
Yes. Yes, that is true. I am. Sometimes I think if you really write in that place of receptivity or negative capability, sometimes you tap into things that you didn't know you knew. And it can be alarming. It can seem almost like prescience sometimes. Yeah, and so sometimes that has frightened me a little bit, surprised me, definitely. It's a strange experience.
We're talking to Joy Castro, who came out with two books this year, Island of Bones, which is a collection of essays, and Hell or High Water, which is a mystery, a thriller set in New Orleans. And you mentioned earlier The Other Latino, which is an anthology edited by Lorraine Lopez and Blas Falconer. And I think the general idea behind that anthology was that there are many Latino writers, including you, who are being published today that don't really fit the mold or the stereotype of what it is to be a Latino writer. And you say in Island of Bones that when you call yourself a Latina, it's a shortcut. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Sure, absolutely. Well, one of the things that Island of Bones explains is that I was adopted at birth, mm-hmm. and the lawyer who facilitated the adoption promised my parents that I was Latina, and he said, probably Cuban-American like you. Like, what's that? I don't know, but that's what he told them, and so that's what they told me. I always grew up knowing I was adopted, but I always grew up knowing that that was also my heritage, and that was my inheritance, my family. I was, you know. And then when I was 26, I did find, after a few years of searching, my biological mother, and I found out that that was not true at all, and that my biological inheritance includes no Latino blood, if you will, none. So it was super confusing for a while, you know. And also it was complicated. All this was complicated by the fact that my father had deeply, deeply bought into the American dream.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was one of those guys, I will work my way up. I won't care when they laugh at me. I will master English. I will blah, blah. I won't. And he didn't use Spanish in our home. And mm-hmm. we were allowed to take it in school, but he wouldn't speak Spanish with us. He wouldn't do it because he had experienced like some police brutality in Miami mm-hmm. as a young man and so on. So that's not an uncommon story, but it's perhaps not the most common story. And so the issue of identity as a Latina was confusing and complicated mm-hmm. for me and for my brother. And so that's kind of what I have come to. But I try to be really transparent and clear with people in case there are any identity police, you know?
No, right. And that's honest because you don't want to misrepresent yourself.
Exactly.
Because if you do misrepresent yourself, then your writing isn't going to have any credibility with people.
Right. And you're not going to have any credibility with yourself.
With yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it really brings the issue of identity to the forefront. I mean, what really is it to be a Latino, a Latina? Is it the experience or is it the blood? You know, you have essay, What My Mother Told Me When I Found Her.
Yeah.
You have it all italicized, but it's also a part of the memoir of the Truth book. Mm-hmm. And so this particular essay is really powerful. It's about being pregnant and being unwanted and being poor and being homeless and all this. And I kind of compare this also to that other essay where you talk about being dirt poor in San Antonio with a child and a partner who made, $600 a month.
Yeah.
And these struggles that you went through, when you look back on them now, how do they figure into your emotional makeup? I mean, do you look at them nostalgically or do you look at them as representative of how tough it can be for young people, young Latinos, young families?
You know, I don't feel particularly nostalgic.
Sentimental poverty, huh?
No, not at all. I mean, it can be grinding. It can be grueling. And there's a lot of, when you're a parent and you don't have the money to take your child to the doctor, that's just a constant anxiety. Or when you live in a place that is unsafe and you know it, that's a constant grinding sort of wear and tear on your psyche. And I think living in that condition just allied me with millions of people all over the world who are living that way and raising their children. You know, you're so invested in your children. You love your children so passionately. Right. And to not quite be able to protect them or give them what they need, that's just a horrible thing.
You know, Joy, given your circumstances and your struggles, you certainly are something of an overachiever. and you got your PhD at Texas A&M.
Yes.
And you got it in literature, Latino studies?
No, modernist literature.
Modernist literature.
Yeah.
So you're getting a PhD. You're not in an MFA program.
Mm-mm.
And you're writing novels. And I assume then you're also publishing in your own field because you're a professor. Do they accept your novels as part of your, accept that as a legitimate publication?
That is such a multifaceted question and so interesting. Yeah, and again, it has to do with communities, right? Which communities accept which kinds of voices.
Right.
Certainly, I was not writing novels when I was in graduate school. I wrote creatively, which I did. They were very, very short pieces. I wrote them as a kind of secret vice and was publishing them and then started publishing articles in my field, the field of modernist literature. Mm. And I did that for several years after I got my first job, my first teaching job. And then I just kept moving more and more into creative writing and being more attracted and thought, okay, I do this better than I do scholarship.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And now the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, where I work, I was nervous when I published Hell or High Water because it participates in a lot of genre conventions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of the thriller, and I keep saying literary thriller, but
right.
But you know, it's a thriller. It's sort of noir. It's a mystery, and so you know, a strictly literary novel, whatever that precisely is, would have been completely fine with my colleagues. But I was nervous about how a novel that's participating in a genre would be accepted. But they have been great, and they do see it as legitimate work. And so I have exhaled. They still speak to me in the hall. And
they probably actually value you very much there at the university.
They are being great to me. They're being really, really wonderful to me. So.
I remember when I had my first novel come out, and I think Ben had a very similar experience. We were in an English department at the time, and it was, you know, majority scholars and majority Ben and I were the only Latinos, and my novel came out with Simon & Schuster with the imprint when it went into paperback, it was supposed to go into pocketbooks. Mm. It ended up going into Washington Square Press, but they said pocketbooks, and when my chair announced it to the other faculty members, one of them came up to me and goes, oh, that's the one that does those detective novels, right? That pop fiction stuff. Completely negating it.
Yeah, there is an astonishing amount of jockeying that goes on in an academic environment.
But your novel, Hell or High Water, it seems to me, even though it's very plot heavy, plot emerges, and even though it's, you know, it just seems that you're the kind of writer, thriller or essay, where you're completely willing to follow the language and let the language take you into the landscape.
That is very kind, and it means a lot coming from a writer like you, so thank you. Yeah, I get lost. The language just drags me around. I just follow.
When you wrote Hell or High Water, did you need to know who your character was before you could actually then write the novel, or did the character emerge as you were writing?
You know, no one has asked me that, but that's such a perceptive question, because Nola was, for me, in the first couple of drafts, still kind of a cipher. Mm. I knew what she had to do in terms of the plot, and I knew what her backstory was and so on, but I couldn't quite get her. And she finally came, I don't know how to explain, you know, like she emerged, she became real to me like on the third or fourth draft when I finally got her voice. And it was like, aha, there you are. Yeah, now I can hear you talking. You know, before I sort of was manipulating you. Now you're manipulating me, and that's much better.
I think that's true. I think until you find the character, at least for me, I always create characters. Mm-hmm. And I don't, for instance, my plots in my work are almost, I don't want to say extraneous because it says that nothing happens. But I'm really just really into creating characters and exploring their psyches. And that's what I do with my stories and with my novels. I know that something has to happen, but I just have to know my character, and only then can I write.
It's like the old equation: plot equals character over time.
Yeah, and you know, in my short fiction, that was always my process. I would just listen, and when a character's voice started kind of speaking to me, then I would follow it wherever it went or didn't go. And you know, being influenced by modernist literature, I think it's a completely legitimate story to have somebody go for a walk and have an epiphany and that's the end, right?
Right.
So, but when I decided I was going to write a novel that was a thriller, I thought, okay, there has to be a plot. It has to come to some, you know, I have to like work backwards from the ending to figure out how the puzzle will go together. So it was this weird new process for me of making characters do things. And so it was a strange, uncomfortable process until they began to kind of, you know, speak.
So you didn't have any issues with the plot. In other words, you already knew the ending and what was going to happen.
Yeah, I worked it out like a mathematical formula in advance. You know, I thought, this is what has to happen at the end, and how do I work backwards from there? Yeah.
I do that in this one way. Before I even write anything about the novel, this is all in my head. I have the first line and the last line.
Yeah.
And I know that I'm working towards that last line.
Yeah, and the journey is what matters, right? The destination is there, but the journey along the way is full of surprises.
Yes.
You know, because you study modernist literature, you know that that kind of literature often takes a lot of aesthetic risks. But we always forget that there's all kinds of risks that we take as a writer. Only there's an aesthetic risk that you take when you write. And the one that we don't think enough about is that emotional risk, that willingness to be vulnerable because it's the truth and you want to tell the truth.
Right. And for me, if that aspect is not intensely there, then it is harder in some way because it feels more like your craft or your labor or your job rather than this amazing free fall.
Joy, thank you so much for joining us for Words on a Wire. We wish you the best success on these two new books. They're both very lovely.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much,
Joy, for being on Words on a Wire.
Thank you.
I'm going to read one of my favorite poems by Yusuf Komunyakaa called My Father's Love Letters. And this poem I find so moving. It's about an abusive father who kept writing love letters to the woman who left the speaker of the poem's mother. And it reminds me of my grandfather, because my grandfather was a very abusive man, and he used to make my grandmother write his love letters to his mistress, which was, you know, kind of double torture, right? It's just a very beautiful, moving poem. It's called My Father's Love Letters. On Fridays, he'd open a can of Jack's after coming home from the mill and ask me to write a letter to my mother, who sent postcards of desert flowers taller than men. He would beg, promising to never beat her again. Somehow I was happy she had gone, and sometimes wanted to slip in a reminder how Mary Lou Williams' polka dots and moonbeams never made the swelling go down. His carpenter's apron always bulged with old nails, a claw hammer looped at his side, and extension cords coiled around his feet. Words rolled from under the pressure of my ballpoint, love. Baby, honey, please. We sat in the quiet brutality of voltage meters and pipe threaders, lost between sentences, the gleam of a 5-pound wedge on the concrete floor pulled a sunset through the doorway of his tool shed. I wondered if she laughed and held them over a gas burner. My father could only sign his name, but he'd look at blueprints and say how many bricks formed each wall. This man who stole roses and hyacinth for his yard would stand there with eyes closed and fists balled, laboring over a simple word, almost redeemed by what he tried to say. That was My Father's Love Letters by Yusuf Komunyakaa. Thank you for joining us for another edition of Words on a Wire. We'd like to thank Joy Castro for being our guest. Don't forget to check out her books, Hell or High Water and The Island of Bones.
And we'd like to thank Yusuf Komunyakaa for writing such beautiful poems.
And make sure you join us next week, same time, same bat channel, same bat place for another edition of our show.
Words on a Wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Benjamin Alita Science.
And don't forget, the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on the tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on the tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see.